I believe that storytelling has the power to transform our lives in the most fascinating and unexpected ways. Over my career as a journalist and social entrepreneur, I met individuals whose passion and values are making this world a better place. I am Elizabeth Filippulli, and I invite you to hear the stories of some amazing, inspirational people. Hi, and thank you for joining us today. I'm delighted to welcome a good friend of mine, Mouna Boussouleiman. Mouna is a broadcaster, philanthropist, social entrepreneur, and she's from Saudi Arabia. In 2007, she was appointed as the first Saudi UNDP Goodwill Ambassador. She's a member of the Young President's Organization, an aspiring novelist, a Yale World Fellow and Aspen Institute Middle East Fellow, and she serves on several nonprofit boards. And she's also, of course, the recipient of numerous awards. Mouna, I'm delighted to welcome you to the program. And I would like to begin, my first question is going to be about your background and your childhood. Tell us more.
My childhood was extremely interesting. I was a third culture kid, somebody who moved from Saudi Arabia to the United States, to Malaysia, to Egypt, back and forth several times across all these countries before the age of 16. And I think that experiencing different educational systems, extremely different cultures, especially Saudi Arabia in the 1980s and 70s, late 70s, was a Bedouin, more desert-like society that had modern visage, but at the same time still retained a lot of the ancient culture. And Malaysia, of course, was a melting pot of Chinese, Indian, and Malay populations that had to go through decolonization as well as understanding each other to be able to come together and build a new society.
When did you go there?
I went there at a very beautiful moment in 1988 and 89 when Malaysia was one of the tigers, or starting to be one of the tigers. And in the US, where I spent a lot of my younger years as well as my college and master time, seeing how a non-Muslim society, because all these other societies were Muslim, a non-Muslim society was able to exist with secular laws and secular culture. I think that gave me a lot of understanding of how the world works, and also how people demonize each other. From a very young age, people are always afraid of the other. And so I think my commitment to understanding cultures, to working with cultures, building tolerance, comes from that background. And of course, I have my father, who is an amazing man and a family man and a dad, but also one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century for the Arab world.
Yes, your father contributed to your understanding of the world as an international community. But I would like to ask you a little bit more about your father's role and his thinking. How did this influence you?
Living with somebody who is so wise, when you're not so wise, allows you to absorb a lot of ways of dealing with things before you even can name them. And naming things is so important. So I learned about being Zen, never making decisions until the very last moment where you have to, so that you can build up as much information as you can. I've learned about integrity. I've learned about keeping your word. I learned about not giving your word until you know if you can keep it or not. So little things like this that enabled me to move through life in a very comfortable way, where I saw a lot of people struggling to figure out what are their value system. Mine was shaped by the time I was 16 years old.
Well, having a value system in place from a very young age, as you did, is a tremendous asset, because a value system is always a compass for one's life. You talked about your life in Malaysia and the US, and I wonder if you have any memories that affected the way you think, the way you operate as an individual.
There are so many moments when somebody is living abroad that become kind of like a cultural transformation. And I think one of the things about it is that you learn how to observe and you learn how to adapt very quickly because you have to fit in. You're thrown into a different school system with different friends, with different culture, you know, almost every 2 years of your life. And also it makes you not attached to things, and that causes issues later in life. But I think one of the most important moments, one happened in the US when I was around, I would say around 10 years old. And I had worn the scarf. I had decided to wear the scarf as a symbol of identity, of retaining my Arabness, retaining my religion, showing people that I'm proud of it. And it was a decision that actually my parents didn't like, but I was a very determined young girl. And I remember we were in Tunisia just before that, and moving from Tunisia to the US on the plane there, I had decided to start wearing the scarf, and I didn't have any scarves. So that was an important point. But what happened was when I went to school, one of the boys that was there had spread a rumor that I had cancer, and that's why I was covering my hair. And remember, this is like 1983, I would say. And then it became a game that people wanted to pull my scarf, and that really built up a lot of resilience, a lot of strength in that when you make a decision and you make it from conviction, and how to actually make people understand that you have rights. So going, you know, as a 10-year-old, going to the principal and having the names of the boys that pulled my scarf off and asking to talk to them and having a conference.
Oh my, that was horrible. Did you tell your parents?
I never even talked to my parents about this, not because of any issue. It's just like I actually dealt with it on my own. And it was, we would call it extreme bullying right now, but at that time I had decided that I would do something about it. So that formed my strength, I think. I realized I was a very strong person at a very young age. And another one was in Malaysia, and that was, I would say, 11th grade or 12th grade. And a Chinese student from Malaysia had joined our class. And so one thing I had learned in the US that communism is extremely bad. Communism is evil. And remember, again, this is in the late 80s. And she came and she was defending communism. And she said, I'm a communist. And we're in an American international school. She looks normal. And I remember that thinking at that moment, that's not what I learned about communism. This is not who they told me communists are. Communists would not go to an American international school. And that kind of like upended a huge understanding of how history and agendas are written and how they are used to make people take stance. And if you don't learn on your own what you're being told and you go and you search, you will be led by those who want to take you somewhere else by an agenda. And maybe you want to go with that agenda, but you have to know that you're going there.
Oh, yes, it is absolutely necessary to always be able to make informed decisions, our own decisions, even if they sometimes may seem controversial to others, they still need to be our own decisions. And we need information to be able to make them as sound and sensible as possible. Anyway, we'll get to that, but before that, I would like to hear more about after high school. What happened? You got married young, I think, yes?
So I got married when I was 17 years old. I had finished first year of university at the time. And I had a baby at 19. And a week later, I turned 20. So this is something that I never thought would be part of my life. I never thought I'd marry young. I never thought I would have a child as a teenager, basically. So this was so difficult to come to terms with, that I was doing things that I didn't think would be a part of my life and having to adapt to it. Of course, life has a way of teaching you lessons. So having my first child very young while I was still studying in the university meant that I had, at 40, free time. I no longer had to take care of young kids. And at a time where I was extremely busy, I didn't have to think about a lot of the things that working moms have to struggle with in their 30s. So my 20s were difficult, but my 40s became extremely easy and to manage. And uh, I I wish somebody told me that because I was struggling in my 20s. So listening to people and who have similar experience is extremely important. Learning from them, understanding how they navigated their own issues, and basically taking the tips, shortcuts. You don't have to learn everything on your own. You don't have to go through the whole, you know, vicious cycle of doubting yourself. Go to people, go to mentors, and take every shortcut you can in helping yourself heal and helping yourself become better, and in networking so that you can get somewhere.
You mentioned your university years. What did you study, and how did these years evolve for you?
I had studied my university in the US and a year in Malaysia and a year in Saudi Arabia. So when that happened, I had decided to do English literature one because I couldn't believe somebody could pay you to enjoy literature, not realizing the hard work of teaching it and then of course grading. But it was something that I loved, and it was something that was easily transferable so it suited my nomad kind of life. And I did my master's in English literature as well because that meant I didn't have to take a GRE test. So again, kind of speeding through. And this was in the mid-90s, I would say. And so I finished my university and I finished my master's. But when I started working, I realized after working for about 4 years at the university teaching that despite how much I love teaching, it wasn't enough for me personally. And there weren't at that time many choices for women to work in the Arab world other than being a teacher, whether at school or university, or a doctor, or somebody who worked at the bank. A few women were business leaders due to their family positioning. A few women were artists, but they were so few and really not very well known or extreme cases.
And how did that make you feel? Was it something like, you know, you wanted to break that social mold that was preventing women from making their own professional choices?
I felt that I had to take whatever opportunity came my way, even if it's something that I didn't like, in order to do things that I would like. One of the interesting things about studying between, again, three different school systems was seeing how universities themselves treat the students. So there are universities that treat students like parents. They're very authoritative. They lead the student in a very strict manner from, you know, the first day that they enter till the end, and it's sort of like shaping them in a certain way. And then there are universities that are like schools. You go there, you memorize, and you leave, and not much critical thinking is developed, not many skills are developed. And then there is the system where basically you can audit courses, you can meet professors that are not your own professor. There's a very lively life, intellectual life outside of the academic world where you are treated as an equal. And seeing those three different systems and benefiting actually from each one, as well as realizing what was missing, I think helped me later on when I was establishing centers in different universities and working with educational systems. So it's always very easy to look and connect the dots backward, as they say, but when you're going through it, when you're going through many changes, you're going through many systems, you're going through a lot of, you know, cultural shocks, it doesn't seem so great. It seems like you're always learning and you're always alone and unique or having a unique experience, and then realizing that it's not so unique. What is unique about it is what you learn from it.
You seem to have this ability to glide smoothly through a variety of different circumstances, and possibly this is thanks to the fact that you had to live across many cultures and many countries. What has the role of mentoring been in your life? And also, were you good at taking advice from others?
So there are two types of advice. There's advice you get from books, from role models that you read about, whether they are from the ancient times or modern times. And there's advice you get from people who are around you. My first role model actually is Anne Sullivan. And not many people know Anne Sullivan, but everybody knows what she did, which is she was the teacher of Helen Keller. And Helen Keller, as we all know, somebody was extremely disabled due to a childhood sickness. So she couldn't see, she couldn't hear, she couldn't talk, and she became almost like a heathen at a certain time. And Anne Sullivan was the teacher that was hired that allowed her, facilitated her genius, her brilliance, her beauty of soul to come through. And I always think about catalysts. So I like being a catalyst of letting other people shine and using whatever gifts that I was given, whether it was because I've lived in so many different places and I belong to so many associations that I have great networking, allowing people to use that and reach somewhere that they didn't know they could reach before. So that's something that really deeply influenced me when I was extremely young. I loved Florence Nightingale. She's extremely famous. And again, this woman who everybody's speaking of because of helping others. This is something that really is part of who I am. And it was part of who I am since I was extremely young because of the books that I read. But as you grow older, there is a stubbornness to some people who are successful, thinking they can do it all. And a lot of people can do it all. But there's going to be a lot of hardship, whether you get advice or you don't get advice. Advice helps you eliminate some of these challenges, some of these hardships, gives you, as I said before, shortcuts. And it's very important for women to network at a professional level, which men have been doing, you know, for eons. Because before we used to connect over book clubs or knitting or, you know, childcare. But women who have moved the world, like the Bloomsbury women, are women who came together and used all their powers for certain missions. They've accomplished a lot of things for women in the Western world, especially. But now that we have reached that place where we look like we have some gender parity, studies are showing us that there's 80 more years to achieve full gender parity in the Western world, I think 60 years in Switzerland, but again, you know, more than my lifetime of work, and probably more than the lifetime of my kids' work.
So what role do you think that such associations and professional networks play for the development of one's professional profile, career, identity?
Establishing networks, whether it's women who graduated from business schools, women in, you know, in politics, women in the business world, these types of associations allow you to network with others who have gone through what you're going through, maybe a little bit less than you, maybe a little bit more than you, and then help navigate your path, give you a name of somebody who can help you to do something. Networking is one of those skills that they don't teach in college, and yet it is extremely important. And there's a difference between nepotism and network, right? Nepotism is you're helping somebody just because they're related to you, whether they're worth it or not. Networking is about finding people who are similar to you, who have professional goals that could help you achieve your own goals.
Well, I think that mentoring is absolutely a critical part that can help you tremendously with your professional development, also how you approach life, how you understand the world. But of course, it is always important that one takes a few steps beyond mentoring into sponsoring a young professional.
The difference between mentorship and sponsorship is that mentorship is somebody who gives you some time to help you reach somewhere, but you're doing most of the work. In a sponsorship, it is somebody who sees your abilities, sees your potential, understand that the world is stacked against women, and actually becomes your advocate, helps connect you to the right people, and then tell them, you know, in the boardroom or in the conferences, that this person should be in that place and will fight for you to get there. And that's something that most women did not have until extremely, extremely recently, and we still don't have enough of it. Now, there are people who are naturally bubbly, there are people who are not so much of an introvert as I am, and they could use other skills. So, for example, if you're going to a conference, there are several people you can meet, right? Let's say you are going to see Arianna Huffington speak. Well, most probably Arianna Huffington is not going to be easy to get to because she is somebody who is extremely busy. She might be just in and out for that, speech that she's giving. But there's going to be people around her. And if you're interested in either her story, what she did in her life, or in her new venture, figure out who's going to be around, research them a little bit.
Well, I'm so glad that you're giving this example, because I think it is very important when we network to have a strategy in place.
What you're trying is to find somebody who has something in common with you, whether they went to the same school as you did, or they have the same interests. What you're trying is to do things that are usually done in different networking associations or at the golf course, but you're not at the golf course, you're at a conference. So you do the research for the second tier of people around her and figure out if there's a way of natural synergy. So for your work later on. It happens also, one of the best places for networking, and I'm sure you know this, is that on the buses, when you're going to conferences, either wait until some people are walking and walk with them, or get on the bus if it's further and there's no walking, and get to know everybody on the bus. If you hear a conversation, this is some of the best, ways of having an informal networking session. You never know who you're going to meet on the bus. And the bus is the great equalizer, right? So Bill Gates is going to get on the bus as well as you.
Oh, totally so. It could be your unique opportunity to be as close to a celebrity or a very, very big name as you will ever get.
The second thing is also make sure that you become an initiator. Do a cold email to somebody that you really admire. You never know if they're also looking for somebody to mentor, or if something in your biography or your work or your passion touches something or reminds them of something in themselves. You'd be very surprised how many people have developed long-term friendships from things like that.
You have a unique career spanning media, philanthropy, social entrepreneurship. But let's begin with media, because you are one of the most familiar faces in the Arab world. And I would like to understand, how did this happen?
One of the most interesting things about my media career is that I fell into it. If there's one thing that I would never have thought I would ever do, is actually be somebody in front of a camera. Part of it, my personality, extreme introversion. Part of it is that I was an academic. And part of it is that at that time, we did not have the kind of programs that were influential and serious, but fun at the same time. And so my TV program was the first one that did that. It combined information, seriousness, but also was very approachable because the women on in front of you reminded you of people who are in your own life. And that was what was very unique and copied afterwards. We were the longest running TV program in the Arab world. We ran for 17 years. Media, and this is the time before the internet, before Twitter, before diversion and short attention span, was the primary way of giving people information. And there's nothing I love more than giving people the right information that can help them. I read a lot on a daily basis. It's something that is part of my own intellectual growth, is to make sure that I understand how the world works. And reading wasn't something that a lot of women did, mainly do because a lot of them got married young. They had a lot of children. I only had two in 10 years between them. So a lot of women didn't have the time to read. And access to information wasn't as easy as just typing something on Google and having, reams and reams of info coming at you in every form that you can think of, whether it's a podcast, a television show, a video, a YouTube, an article. And so this is the reason that I agreed to do it. I thought that I could actually offer people a different point of view. And remember, Saudi at the time was not a very well-known place, even to the rest of the Arab world. We were extremely private. Women didn't come on TV as much as they should. And I was the first Saudi to be on a pan-Arab show. And so people saw a Saudi woman, not as a guest for 5 minutes, you know, in a news broadcast, but rather somebody who is giving her opinion from Morocco all the way to Iraq. And also the Arab diaspora. We got a lot of emails from the Arab diaspora who were watching this.
That was tremendous, Muna. I mean, think about it. It was a revolution for the Saudi society, and you were the face of it, really. So how did you feel?
It opened up the world for me because, as I said, it helped me get access to anybody that I wanted to get access to. But at the same time, it also forced me to read into things that I didn't think about. So I lived a very different life from the typical Arab family in the 1990s and the early 2000s, due to my parents and due to our traveling. The type of information that I was able to talk about represented me, but I also had to understand how do they think about something? Because if you want to shift society to a point, first of all, you need to understand what is that point? What does it mean to you? What does it mean to them? And is it really good for society or not? Because you can't just import things and impose things on people. And so I have to do a lot of reading, a lot of understanding about culture, about where I'm willing to change my own stance as well, where I need to help people move to where I am at, and where there's actually a middle ground. And that was a huge learning experience for me.
Can I ask you to give us some real life stories that you came across when you were having the program, the TV program, and you felt that they were eye-opening for you?
I think about, for example, literacy for women. For me, it was always about the pleasure of reading, right? So when I talked about illiteracy, I would talk about how much you're missing. And I would talk about information, and I talk about escapism, and I talk about all these kind of things. And then I met somebody who actually had an illiterate mother, and I said, please let me meet her. I would love to meet somebody who can't read and understand how they see the world. And of course, she was an extremely wise person, an elderly woman. And she said, the only reason I want to read is so I know how to take my medicine, and I don't mix it up because I don't want something bad to happen to me, but also I hate bothering my children. You know, I hate bothering my children. She doesn't want to go every time she's taking the medication to make sure that she's taking it at the right time, or is this one with food or not. And she was, you know, she was an ill woman. She had a few sicknesses, so she had a lot of bottles. And I was like, that's something that I never thought about. I never thought about talking about illiteracy, which was one of the main themes that we had at the time to help society get over, is your own health. And so, as I said, you learn about what moves people, you learn about what helps them, and you learn how to adjust yourself to these things. And I don't think that would have happened without the show, because we had six segments every show. And so it was about six different topics that you would need to understand where you stand on, what is the gap in information, and as well as where do people stand and what do they need to know.
I come from the world of media myself, and I know it is a tough one. So what would be your advice to a younger woman who wants to go for a career in media today?
I get a lot of questions from young people, especially young women. How can they enter the media world? And I guess it was an opportune moment for me because it was a networking moment where somebody who I knew was talking about the new show. And I said, I would like to write for the show. And they said, why don't you present? And it's something that never occurred to me. And I went into it not to actually become a presenter, but at the time I didn't know how news was made. And they said the audition will be at the newsroom. And I said, can I actually take a full tour of the whole place? I wanted to see how the whole news gets made. And they're like, yeah, sure, you can spend the whole day there. And so I went to actually learn about the news. I didn't really think I would ever get the job. I got the job, you know, and the rest is history, but it wasn't something that it was intentional. Now you need to be intentional about these things. First of all, because there's so many modes of media, you can't just send a resume anymore or say that you studied communications. You have to show that you know how to use media. If anybody wants to enter in the air world, they need to have a podcast, they need to have a video, YouTube channel, they need to show that they're doing the reporting. Whatever area they want to enter, they have to show the work. Internships are extremely important and they're very difficult to come by. So this is where your networking comes in. Once you realize you want to enter and you want, for example, to be in production or to learn from a director, you have to ask everybody you know if they know people on these shows or, you know, in your area. You have to do your research, and just like until you find the person who would believe in you and introduce you, because, you know, media now, everybody who has a telephone is a media personality. You do a Snapchat and it can go viral, or a TikTok, and for people to enter media, they have to show that they have something a little bit more than that to offer, and that they know how to use it.
When you and I started in media, that whole social media ecosystem did not exist. And I'm wondering, how do you manage this equilibrium? How do you juggle the two worlds?
Social media in the Arab world started, I think, around 2009, with very few people getting on Twitter. Facebook was never very popular in Saudi Arabia, but it was popular in, I think, Egypt and in Morocco, mostly for communication, not for sharing information. And I think when Facebook started having the news feed, that's when the information part came in. 2011, with the Egyptian revolution, was the time that a lot of normal people started to get on Twitter, which was, and we, Saudi Arabia is still the main, I think, one of the top users for that application, because they wanted to know what was happening with the Egyptian revolution. So 2011 was a turning point for people getting on social media, mostly from the male persuasion. But Instagram is the one that pulled in a lot of women into social media. And then, of course, Snapchat came in, and TikTok now, and all these kind of different applications that look at how can you connect. So at its base is that people want to connect with each other, want to discover new people, want to discover, you know, humans around the world that think the same or like the same things, or they want to talk to or understand. It's a beautiful way of connecting humanity, right? But what has happened in the past few years is that it has become a bullying arena, especially Facebook and Twitter. It has become a place where there's a lot of misinformation. I don't like to say false news, because we need news. We can't live without news. We cannot make decisions without knowing what happens. And the credibility of the news has deteriorated for two reasons. One, because we also keep on using these kind of terminology, and so reinforcing that negativity about it.
You know, I often receive that question about objectivity in media. What do you think? Does objectivity exist?
I mean, there's no such thing as true objectivity, but there's an attempt at it, right? And, you know, certain places will have a Western objectivity. So if you read the same story in the East, it wouldn't be the same. And that's understandable for cultural reasons, as well as history and politics. And you can't be everything to everybody. But in your part of the world, wherever you are, you need a voice of objectivity that allows you to make your own decisions. And we're losing that.
Can we fight it? Are there things that we can do to break this cycle, vicious cycle, really, of misinformation?
I don't think there is one place that you can think of that is not the news presenters or the show hosts have not become, leaning towards one left or right in one way or another, and you kind of like know it, and so you watch it if you want that. Even comedy has become too polarizing, and I don't see a change soon, but I think there will have to be a change. We have to hit rock bottom. So one of the things that I've done is I've helped co-found Midan Labs, which has a lot of projects under it, including Midan itself, which is in Egypt, based in Egypt, but it's global, where we look at how can we verify in the news, how we can help both the news organizations understand whether the news that they're getting, that they're going to be covering, is actually real or not. Then we have ways of disseminating the information. Now we've moved to WhatsApp because WhatsApp has become one of the top places of misinformation, for example, in India. And it's through algorithms and it's through trial and error, but it's a way to rehabilitate the reputation of a very important pillar of society. There's a reason it's called the fourth estate.
So from media to philanthropy, and from philanthropy to entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship, actually, how did the journey unfold?
It's a very interesting pathway that I've taken all over my professional career. So I actually started in academia, and then I went into philanthropy, and then I went into media, and then I went into entrepreneurship and social impact. And in a way, they're all connected. So I pursue opportunities that make sense for my mission in life, which is about information, how to make sure people get the right information in whichever way, right? So in media, it was about society. What is the kind of information that women and families needed to thrive? And I provided it to them. I didn't realize I'd become a role model for people. And, you know, now you're seeing a lot of young girls coming up and saying, I saw you and I remember when you said such and such thing and it stuck with me, or I thought that way, but when I heard you say it, I realized I wasn't the only person, or my father heard you and now realized that what I was saying wasn't something that is so out of the ordinary. So there's a lot of satisfaction in just being on TV and talking, despite all the research one does beforehand, and influencing. I went into philanthropy. I got the opportunity to actually combine my media and my academic backgrounds. There was a project to create centers of cultural understanding between the East and West with Abdullah Ibn Talal. And I presented a proposal and he liked it and we started working together. And then it formalized from just one project into almost 9 years of work with him, spanning humanitarian aid, community development, female empowerment, as well as the cultural understanding that we started with. And that opened up a lot of worlds again for me, where I realized how change can happen. And so entrepreneurship was one of the places that I realized if you do investments in people, or you invest in small startups, whether it's your own time and money and expertise or somebody else's, you allow for important changes to happen to help people live a better life, to help them thrive. And so everything always revolved around the same kind of thing. How do you use whatever potential pool you have, whether it's money or information or expertise, changing people's lives to the better?
Well, for those of us who've known you for years, we're very familiar with your dedication to improving people's lives, to always be there to help. And I wonder, Muna, have you ever felt tired?
As I finished my work with philanthropy, I realized that I love philanthropy. I love spending money on things that I think are important and developing the teams, but I was also burnt out. It's not easy to be faced with so many calamities around the world. I think the humanitarian aid especially was perhaps one of the toughest things I've ever had to do, because you're making decisions every time you're giving money to an organization. You're helping that organization help people. So you're helping moms, you know, feed their kids, or you're helping people overcome an earthquake disaster, or you're helping build technology for better agricultural products, you know, especially in places that are deserts. But every time you're giving money to somebody, you are saying no to somebody else. And it's all dire needs. And my admiration for people who work in the humanitarian field exploded, because it was only part of my work and it was so heavy It was so difficult to go to sleep because you get the pictures of the people that you did not help, right? I have puzzles. And that burnt me out personally.
Well, during this pandemic, what we have witnessed is the need for our societies to become more collaborative. So we need to see more collaboration between governments, philanthropy, the social sector, activism, media. We are much more interconnected and interdependent than we would like to think, right?
With what has happened with COVID-19, we are realizing that there's a regression of developmental goals. That we have for the first time in 30 years an increase in people who are going to bed hungry. We have a huge increase in children not being educated. 50% of the 1.5 billion people, students that went online, did not have access to the internet. 50%. So 50% of all students lost a year of their life, while the other 50 either didn't lose it or lost just a tiny bit due to their own circumstances. So we already have a big gap between students. So COVID-19 presented kind of like all the foundational gaps and weaknesses and put them right up front and center, and these things have to be resolved. It's not about having everybody go into the middle class, because that is impossible, unrealistic. It is about ensuring that there are minimums for life for everybody. And that's not easy. And that doesn't come except if everybody works together. And that doesn't come when you have leadership that is selfish or that is polarizing or that is not very well educated, or you have people denying facts. That doesn't happen except when we all agree to actually come together with basic assumptions and basic facts, and then figure out how we work according to our different capabilities as governments, and then trickling down to organizations and then trickling down to individuals.
Let me ask you something else. How can we change the reality for women in parts of the world where they're being attacked simply because they claim their right to knowledge, to education, like in the case of Malala, for example?
Malala, by the way, was not attacked for going to school. There was a lot of girls on the bus. And that's a very important part, because that's also false assumptions, right? There is education in Afghanistan and Pakistan and India and all these poor countries for girls. She was attacked for speaking up. And that's even more vital, because if you educate women but do not allow them to speak up, do not allow them to have opinions at the risk of death, that's something that has to be changed. I don't like the word voiceless. Everybody has a voice. They're silenced. We cannot let minorities, women, the other be silenced. We have to have dialogue, even if we don't agree. We cannot just pull out of treaties, and we cannot just stop going to conferences. We have to work together, as I said, with basic assumptions, and then figure out how to do it according to our capability.
We have been talking about this stellar career of yours, but I wonder, did you ever have any failures?
I went from philanthropy into my own businesses. So I started my own business, which is a complete failure. First business, complete failure. It was fashion for people who wear hijab, because I always suffered from trying to find appropriate clothing that fit the modern woman versus something that looks very ethnic or looks very kind of 80s. And at that time, that did not exist. But I'm not a businesswoman. I realized that if you want to do a business, you need to have the right team that, or the right founders with you, who also have a stake in what you're doing and want it to succeed, not just to hire people if you're not a business person. And so that took a very long time for me to realize that it was failing. that it was an ego issue. It was the first time actually I've ever failed in anything in my whole life. I know it's not easy to think about that, but somehow all my life, everything that I've done, if it wasn't a great success, it was still successful. And so this was the first time where I had to come to terms with complete failure, loss of finances, that my life saving. Also another thing, never go in with your life savings. Try to always work with other people's money. Try to get funding. There's a lot of funding open for people. Work on the funding. So I wish somebody told me that, maybe a mentor or something like that.
And what did you learn from that challenge?
I couldn't do what I do today without having all that experience beforehand and knowing where my weaknesses are, but also knowing where my strengths are. I think we doubt ourselves a lot. Women think about, you know, their strengths in the way that what do men do well, and kind of like measure ourselves in that way only, because that was the business world, that was what got your promotion. And I'm part of the change, right? I'm part of the second generation of women who went through leadership roles who are now saying, no, we're going to redefine what our strengths. How should a culture work that fits both male and female modes of operation? How can we change this whole ecosystem to really accommodate female and male needs and make them all human needs? And so this is a very interesting point in my life. I'm really enjoying it. I'm also enjoying that being operations, right? It's not my issue if we can't make payroll, somebody else's issue.
Well, as citizens and as individuals, we have taken a lot of hard lessons over the past year, I would say, and we have been forced to rethink the ideas of accountability and responsibility and respect. And I wonder, is there a right way to do things?
If you don't have credible media giving objectivity, giving credibility, giving positivity as well to what happens with the news, then the voters don't get the information. They can't vote right. And the leaders doesn't have to have accountability to his voters to do the right thing. So it's a cycle. You can't just take one part.